Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Say big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I'm joined today by a very special guest. Someone we've heard from before, and he's actually kind of the impetus to the investigative journalism class and the Underestimated podcast that I do in my teaching. I interviewed Alex Campbell about 3 years ago. It was 2023 after the Murder 101 podcast came out, which was a podcast about the work that he did in his sociology class at Elizabethtown High School in Tennessee. And since then, I don't do a lot on social media. I got on, I'm like, holy crap, they're still going. They're writing books. They're doing documentaries. They're doing all kinds of stuff. So I reached out to Alex and asked him to come join us and talk about what's been going on with the students since then. So first and foremost, Alex, thanks for that. It seems like you're busy. I saw you. Were you in Times Square? I saw you posted a picture of a billboard in Times Square.
So the billboard was actually on Sunset Strip.
Okay.
And I was not in California, but a friend of mine who works there, lives there, he drove out and got a picture of the billboards once we heard that they were going up. So I wasn't actually there.
It's so awesome that you're getting the kind of recognition, you and your students, for the work that you guys are doing. Because you're doing, you know, this season of Truth and Justice is all about justice warriors and people that are like doing real work in the space and not just, you know, making content for the sake of content or just spinning wheels. You, in an interesting way, you know, people expect from my class is an investigative journalism class. We're investigating things and making content about it, or, you know, a criminal justice or criminology class. But you were, at least what you were, where I'm gonna catch up with you, were teaching a sociology class that like morphed into this like crime solving group of young adults. So first off, go ahead and explain, just for anybody that hasn't listened to the old conversation and isn't familiar, what it is you do and what your class, you know, aimed to do. What was it, about 2018 when you guys started doing this?
Yeah, right. So I'm a high school social studies teacher. I teach mostly world history, U.S. history, and sociology. And yeah, about 2018, I decided to use true crime in my classroom. It really got the kids excited, like nothing I'd ever really seen before. And believe it or not, it kind of bleeds over into some of my other classes, too. In U.S. history this year, we did, I don't know if you know, but there's a type of ballad that's kind of home is in East Tennessee here in Appalachia. It's called the Murder Ballad. And so, yeah, there's a lot of famous old murder ballads and crime ballads. So my students actually wrote 8 original crime or murder ballads, you know, so I find this true crime thing, it's taken over all my classes, you know.
That's great. But,
yeah, I try to use just authentic projects in my classes. And it seems like true crime is something that really, it really just gets the kids working really hard and they realize that there's work to be done and people to be helped. And so, hey, if I can teach them a lot and help them learn some really important skills and also help people at the same time, I figure that's a great thing to do.
First of all, just as an educator, I'd love it. You know, like I've invited Alex's on our advisory board for my course because it's such a unique approach instead of just, you know, bringing kids in and just doing the same thing everybody else is doing in world history class or in sociology class, but like finding ways to get the kids actually interested and engaged. I just absolutely love that. So talk to me about, it's 2018. Was it beginning of the year you had this idea or how did this idea come to you?
Yeah. You know, there was just a string of unsolved murders in Tennessee and also around Tennessee, kind of throughout the Southeast. They were loosely called the Redhead Murders, and depends on kind of the criteria you use, but maybe as many as 26 women with red or reddish hair were killed and usually disposed of along the highway in Tennessee and kind of around Tennessee in the Southeast. Police had looked at it. They even had like a multi-agency task force meeting once in 1985, but they never determined if these were related crimes or maybe, you know, one killer was responsible for all of them or some of them. And when they stopped happening around 1985, that was it. Nobody else was identified after 1985. No suspects, you know, no attention. I didn't see anything about it in the newspapers. I had never heard of it. So I just really put this to the kids. Can we tell if there was a serial offender operating in and around our state in the 1980s? And that was the question that got it all started.
How did you come up with it? Were you just sitting around thinking, what can I do with these kids? Or was it a story you were interested in? Like that? It's always interesting to me, like the connection with a teacher like this, where it's like, I've got this idea and it gets presented to it. Like there's a process there. You know, nobody gave you a curriculum that said, I want you to have your kids solve a murder. Like you came up with this. So, you know, how did that happen?
So I was teaching down in the vocational area of our school and, you know, just sitting around talking, leaned up against the wall there, watching the kids move between classes, you know, talking to teachers. You know, hey, what are you doing in your class? What are you learning? You know, what's exciting? And the criminal justice teacher was my friend, and we were just talking. And we were talking about, you know, I covered things like deviance, power structures. We do cover some things in the criminal justice system. And he was like, hey, you know what? We should team up. And he said, you know, you've got your class, I've got my class. He said, what if we worked on a project together and then, you know, we could swap classes. I would teach my kids about criminal justice. You teach them the sociology and then we'll switch. And then you can teach mine and I'll teach yours. And then maybe we'll do a project. And I said, okay. So he reached out to our local law enforcement and they had a girl who had been murdered in the 1980s. It was an interesting case. They felt like they knew who was responsible. I think all those people were dead except one. I think it had been so long, they kind of felt like they were never going to be able to solve it. But they did actually talk to the family and say, you know, this is what we've got. We can't prove it in court, but we feel like we can tell you with a high degree of certainty who's responsible for your daughter's death. And the mom kind of seemed happy with it. So in a way, it had some closure to it. And they were willing to share that case with us and let the students use it as a way to learn. And so, you know, when my students got into that case, we actually found out that a couple of years later, when one of the suspects was in jail, kind of a jailhouse snitch came out and said that he told me where he threw the knife. But because it'd been a couple of years later, the cops never really went and looked for it. So we actually got to go and look for the murder weapon. That was pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
We learned how to do grid searches, and the kids all had to learn how to use metal detectors. And it snowed that day, so we were out there in the freezing cold, digging in the snow, but the kids loved it. You know, normally to ask a kid to go out and dig in a snowbank, they're
right,
going to have a lot of fun. But they just thought it was the greatest thing ever because the sheriff, you know, got on the bus and said, you know, appreciate what you guys are doing, appreciate the work you've done. And the detective said, if you find a knife that looks like what this one guy described, we'll go arrest the only guy still left alive and we'll have somebody in jail by tonight. And the kids were like, oh my goodness. You
know, that'll motivate them.
Yeah, the work we're doing can actually have an impact. We didn't find the knife, by the way. But the thing is, I saw that passion and it blew me away. But the next semester, he said, you know, I've got baseball. I'm going to be busy. I don't think I can kind of put that kind of time into a big project like that. But what I found out was this girl that had been murdered in our county was a teenager. She was white. She had reddish hair. She was small. She was thrown out beside the road in Tennessee. And when I actually started looking up things on the internet, I started seeing the Redhead Murders, which were all young, small, white, reddish-headed women thrown out beside the road in and around Tennessee in the 1980s. And I just had to know, you know, was this a serial killer or wasn't? So that's really what got my wheels turning. And I just said, let's give it to the kids and see what they can do with it.
That's great. And so you had described to me, and it's kind of, I took that model into my own class, how once you guys got going on this, you would walk into class every day and ask me, what are you going to do to move your case forward today? You know, what do you, and I kind of did the same thing. And for me in my classroom, I just saw it, not all these kids, actually very few of them, only I think three so far have gone on to be, you know, to journalism school or law enforcement. Most of them aren't going down that career path, but there's this skill set that you're teaching by, instead of the normal, okay, here, read this, regurgitate this, but posing that question, which again, you know, I stole from you when I had you on here a few years ago, it just does something different to the kids because it causes them to think in a different way. It causes them to, it's not just, oh, you tell me what to do, I do it. It's, I have to figure out what to do. And for me, like I have a lot of, you know, there's always struggles with some of those, you know, there's days they come in, they're like, I don't know what to do. And instead of just saying, well, do this, you know, it's to sit, you know, sitting down with them and like, all right, let's talk through it. What have you done so far? How could we, what's a lead? What's a string we can pull on, you know? And I just think it's such a valuable skill. And it, are you still using kind of that model with your kids when you go into the classroom every day?
Sure. You know, it's a little different every year, but I think all teachers should be teaching the same things. We should be teaching what we want our young people to be when they grow up, right? Right. The only difference is we should just wrap it around our content. So that might be wrapped around English or math or science or whatever. So, you know, I think it's important that we develop these skills in the kids. And, you know, welcome to life. When you hit a point where you're not really sure what the next step should be, like that's just life, you know? And we kind of do kids a disservice, I think, by making it look like everything is prescriptive and it's laid out for you. But really, many times you don't really know what to do. And that's when you really have to rely on some of these skills. So, you know, we always have some things we're doing, but exactly how to figure it out to get it done, you know, that's where the hard skills come in. You know, the critical thinking, the connecting with experts who can maybe guide you, you know, going back and researching more, whatever. So, we still do that.
Mm-hmm. It is such a huge skill. And so you guys, when we spoke in 2023, when I had you on the show, you know, that was shortly after the iHeart's Murder 101 podcast came out, which wasn't a podcast you guys produced. And that was kind of a distinction at that point between the class I was teaching and the class you were teaching. As in mine, they were doing investigative work, but they were making content too, which, you know, puts a little hitch in the whole system for me, because, you know, I hit about halfway through that first semester. I'm like, okay, now we got to start talking about how we make this into a script and how we do all that. But if you could real briefly talk about the progress they made that kind of sparked Murder 101, and then I want to move on to what you guys have been doing since then.
You know, a couple of things that really kind of move cold cases forward is usually advances in science, you know, like genetics, mm-hmm. or bringing renewed attention to cases. That's usually the two big things.
Right.
And this case needed both. Really, there was not any attention really being paid to any of these women. Like I said, one was identified in 1985, and there was no women that had been identified. They weren't talking about it. There was no suspects. There were no leads. So really, the kids wanted to bring some attention back to it, because the big thing is if you don't have anybody identified, then they don't have a family or friend group that's, you know, pushing the police to do something. So they didn't really have anybody in their corner. So my students decided that, you know, they would be in their corner. And even if they didn't have a name, they wanted these cases to be brought back up. So that was one thing. The second thing was that they did the work with an FBI profiler to show that there was a lot of evidence that at least some, not all, but at least some of these murders were related probably to one offender. And so by naming him the Bible Belt Strangler and getting that out there, oh, they've named a new serial killer, that brought a lot of attention to the mm-hmm. case as well. And so before you know it, we had the first identification just a couple of months later. The first ID in about 35 years happened, and that was Tina Farmer was identified. And then when they went back and, you know, started doing some DNA testing with modern techniques, actually solved her case. And when they solved her case, the person who was responsible for it fit the student's profile 100%. So now we've got, not only have we solved a crime and identified one victim, but now there's a suspect to look at and some of the other crimes that the student showed were probably related. And to be honest, that's kind of where the cases are today, trying to figure out if he was the one to commit some of the other ones. And now it's kind of funny. When we came out in 2018 and the student said, you know, we feel there's evidence for a highway serial killer in Tennessee in the 1980s, killing usually, you know, prostitutes or transient women and leaving them beside the road. I mean, there was some law enforcement that came out and said, there's no evidence of that, you know.
Yeah.
But now, this is where it leads to this year. You know, my students wrote a book about the 9 highway serial killers of Tennessee. There wasn't just one. There were 9 serial killers stalking the highways of Tennessee in the 1980s. It's amazing kind of the attention and the new work that's been done just in the past 8 years.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
And that is incredible. When I saw that you guys, your class of teenagers, wrote and published a book, so there's all this investigative work going on. I'm just thinking in my class, like, okay, it's come time now. You need to write a 3,000 word script, and it's, you know, it's a slog. They do it and they do an amazing job, but it, you know, they're working in groups. That's always a tricky dynamic, and who's doing what, and their voices, you know, don't sound the same. And that's the biggest struggle, is getting the script written. And you managed to coordinate. How many students were in the class did the book?
There was almost 30, like 28, 29.
So you got 30 young adults to put their heads together and write a book. I don't even know what question to ask. Just explain to me how the hell you did that.
Well, how I started the class was, I have a case file on each victim now, you know, sometimes hundreds of documents. And mm-hmm. So I just divided the kids into groups, gave each one of them one of these victims, and said, learn everything you can about them, and I want you to teach each other. So that's how we begin to, you know, get into the case, because I have a new group of students every year. You say,
right,
I've been working on it for 8 years, but these kids, they don't work on it for more than a semester or a year at a time. So that's how we taught each other. And I just ask them, you know, be looking for patterns when you're listening to each other's presentations. And they did notice, again, that there are several victims that really look like they probably were killed by the same person. But they also noticed there's some that didn't really fit the pattern. So the next question they had for me was, were there other killers or serial killers active in the state? And I said, that's a good question. So that's where they moved. So they began to look, and there was 20 serial killers in our state in the 1980s, which is crazy.
Wow.
Because by statistics, with the size of our state, this should only be in about maybe 5 or 6. So the fact that there was 20 and then 9 highway killers just really blew the kids away. And when they began to look at them, they found out that some of these killers, I mean, even though these people are in prison today, I mean, they are bona fide, certified serial killers. Like, the work has been done. The proof is out there. There's virtually nothing online about them. One of my groups found 2 sites on the internet that mentioned their killer, who's in prison right now. And they said, how can this be? How can there just be such little information? Because if you go look at some other cases, like, I don't know, Zodiac or whoever, right? You're going to have like so much stuff, you can't even go through it.
Right.
Or if you look at some victims like JonBenet Ramsey, I mean, there's so much stuff, like, you'd never even get to it all. So the kids began to wonder, why do some of these cases or some of these killers or some of these victims get so little attention? And I told them, you know, if you feel that these cases and these killers deserve the attention, they deserve to be known for who they are and what they've done, maybe even find some victims that nobody's really looking for anymore. If the information's not out there, you're going to have to put it out there. And so they began to, we filed hundreds of information requests. And we started getting some information that you just can't find online. And so sure. I told the students, you know, what are you going to do with it? And they said, we have to get it out there. And so that's when the idea of publishing the book came around.
Who came up? Was there a particular person? Because it's hard for me to imagine, like, for a group of kids to be like the way the medium that we want to put this out in is a book. Was that your idea? Or did one of the students come up with that? Where did that come from?
I don't even know where it came from. It just happened. But here's what happened was, I mean, there was so much information, right? You've got 9 killers and hundreds of victims, possibly hundreds of more victims. They killed in 25 states because they were highway killers. Tennessee, but other states too. Most of them were not even from Tennessee. 7 of them were not from Tennessee. So there was so much information. You couldn't do it in a press conference. You can't do it in an hour-long podcast. So what was the right way to do it? And I think we just settled on the book as a choice. And we just tried to find the biggest publisher in our region. And they were brave enough to join us on that journey.
So how did, because there's a process there. Right. So like you don't just write a book because you guys didn't just self-publish it. You had a publisher that published it for you. Usually there's like a pitch process. Like how did you tackle that?
Yeah. So the students all had their research, you know, so groups that we had 9 different groups working on the different serial killers. And so the students had all this work. And I said, OK, let's begin to put in some type of narrative. Right. We've got a timeline, you know, but let's put in some type of narrative. And we also created criminal profiles of them. We also looked at their MO, their signature, the type of victims they liked, all those type of things. So we had all this information. I said, let's see if we can kind of put that into a narrative form. So we had done that. And I said, hey, why don't I just send some of this to a publisher and see if they think there's something there for a book? And he did. She did a Zoom call with us, and she said, I think there's something here. And she gave us like 3 weeks to write a first draft of one section. And she said, if it's good and I feel like it's something we want to put our money behind, I'll let you know. So, man, for 3 weeks, those kids wrote like crazy and sent her the manuscript, and she was impressed. And they decided that they did want to help us publish the book.
That's fantastic. I want to get into the mechanics of that piece of it here in a second too. But then also, like, the way a publishing deal normally works is a publisher will give you in advance, you know, an amount of money that is kind of, I always look at as a kind of like front loading what you're going to get in royalties from the book, and they give you that money to write the book. And then once it's published, then once that's eaten up, eventually you start getting royalties from it. So I have to imagine that this had to have raised, did that money go into this program, into the school? Was it, you don't need to tell me the number, but was it a significant amount that like went back into your program?
Yeah. So we went with what we call a hybrid publisher. Okay. Most people only get those advances if they're really well-known authors.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they know they have a proven commodity that's going to make them money. So they're okay with giving you some money up front. But what we did, we went with a hybrid publisher where we had to actually raise money up front to pay for their cost, you know, their editing, creating a cover, ISBN numbers, you know, working with all those people, plus the printing cost, all those type things. So we actually had to raise that money.
Okay, and, so the other way around.
Yeah, so we raised the money, but then we also received royalties. And we scheduled it so that all the royalties or the money made from all the books goes actually into a fund that will fund future sociology projects. So it's paying it forward to the students who are yet to come. Now, look, I don't think anybody's going to get rich, retire, anything off this. You know, I don't know. Look, what we've done is we've created, the book is interesting. It's in 3 parts. The first part, a lot of people question students. If you don't work with some of our young people, sometimes you question like the quality of work that they can do. And I've got to be honest, if you go down to Walmart, you might see some young people and wonder about the quality of work. So mm-hmm. I get that. So the first third of the book was actually them talking about how they did it, the research, FOIA requests, the professionals they worked with, you know, how they did it. And I think that helped to kind of let people say like, wow, okay, they really did have a really expert kind of formulaic, you know, professional way of doing it. The second half of the book, the students had to use their sociology to answer this question. Why were there so many serial killers in our state? You know, this isn't California. Yeah. It's not Texas. like, where are all these killers coming from and why were they coming here? And that's a very fascinating chapter to me. The students found five different things that were probably playing into this. They did a good job with that. And then the third part is really just nine profiles of killers with a timeline, an MO, a signature, a victimology, and then a summary of each killer. And then also maybe some other cases which need to be researched that could possibly be linked to some of these killers. So it's broken up into different parts. We did a part at a time. And look, we really just broke it down, right? So, you know, when we had those five parts in that one section, I had five groups. And so, you know, you're writing your section, you're writing your section. And we were able to get a lot of work done quickly. We really wrote that book in about two months, maybe. And plus we had to do all, I mean, where it's, they do have editors and stuff that go through it. We have to approve all changes. That's where it's different. Normally, if they give you an advance, you give them a work and they pretty much do what they want with it. But it's a hybrid publisher. So we had to approve all changes, you know, which was good. The kids felt they had some control over their voice and what they wanted. But so anyway, it was a long process. But man, the books were printed. They got there like 2 days before the press conference because they were trying to give us as much time as possible to review and try to make the product as good as we could in the amount of time that we had. But I mean, we even sold cookies. I had a couple of students that we were in culinary, and they loved cooking, and so that we lacked like $300 after we'd done a couple of fundraisers. And he said, I'm going to make cookies. So I bought him the ingredients. He made the cookies. We sold all the cookies. We put the money into it, and we were able to get everything done.
What other types of fundraisers did you? Because that would be a pretty big chunk of money you had to come up with.
I mean, it wasn't crazy. It was over $1,000, you know, just to get the original stuff done. But what we did, number one, we sold ads in the book. So there are people that wanted to support the students' work, and they actually bought ads in the book, and that was great. Some people just donated, local people, families, different people wanted to donate, educators, people that really just believed in the work of the students. And then we actually wrote a grant, a local grant for, $300, $400 that goes into help educational projects locally. And then finally, the cookies put us over the edge.
That's awesome. That's great. So what is the book called and where can people get it?
Yes, the book is called Driven by Rage, Fueled by Diesel, The Forgotten Victims of the Tennessee Highway Hunters.
What a great title.
Oh, yeah. The kids, of course, it is about some of the killers, but we wanted to make sure it was really about the victims as well, especially the victims that are still waiting on justice who are probably related or could be related to some of these cases. So the kids want to make sure they got the emphasis on the victims in there as well. It's available at all your major, you know, distributors, book distributors. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble, whatever, Books a Million. You'll find it there. So, yeah, you can really get it about anywhere. That's one of the things that going through a publisher does for
right.
You know, she was able to get us that distribution. So, hey, it's on, the electronic book. It's on the hard copy. We've got hardback. We've got softback. So we've got anything that you want, and you can should be able to find that about anywhere.
Has there been any talk about making an audiobook out of it?
Well, it did come to my mind. I don't know anything about that, how much that costs or what it takes to do that. But I will say this. It's not a narrative, so to speak, right? It's not a mystery novel. It's really a collection of case files on those killers and then a little bit of like a deep dive case investigation on the why and the how. So, I don't know, maybe somebody reading a 26-page timeline is not the most exciting thing to hear. So maybe it doesn't fit a good, you know, kind of a novel like that. I don't know. But what I found, and to be honest, I mean, I read this thing like 50 times, right?
Before. Yeah, right.
I mean, what I didn't realize was I had 30 kids writing, but there was only one person kind of editing, right? And that was me. I was reading.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I was reading so many pages. I was reading about 4 hours a day of the work because the kids were just, I mean, they were cranking it out, you know, but I was trying to do it all myself. But when I actually sat down and read, you know, the hard copy, what I thought might be boring, you know, the timeline really kind of fascinated me because the timeline is where you can really see every major event in this killer's life. I mean, some of the kids went and found their grandparents and their parents. And like what was happening in their lives and how this happened and where they had been and where could we look to find victims and how many times they were arrested and let go to victimize more people. And so to me, like even a part of the book that I thought might be not so exciting, I also found fascinating. So maybe the kids did a great job.
Yeah, well, and especially with a true crime audience that are like my audience in particular, that, you know, they're all like getting engaged and helping solve crimes. I mean, that's that kind of data is what they're really looking for. So that's fantastic, man. And I keep, as a teacher, every time you're talking about all these 30 students, right, all I'm thinking of is like how much drama had there. There had to be, you know, so-and-so is not pulling their load, this and that. But it doesn't sound like you guys had a lot of that.
Well, that does happen, right? You're a classroom teacher, you know. But that's those skills you're working on, right? I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
Kids are going to grow up. They're going to be part of some group and they're going to have to get along with people. They're going to have to disagree with people in the right way, right? Productive.
Correct.
And so, yeah, there's those things. And that's where you have to have talks with the groups, you know, mm-hmm. about, hey, who's doing what? Who's pulling the load? You know, I'm seeing this person write 4 pages. I saw you write 1 paragraph. Like, what's going on here? Is that fair? And sometimes it was fair. Well, they've been doing a lot of the research and I've been doing more. Mm-hmm. Okay. But that's all part of them learning how to be adults and learning how to work with each other. And I had to jump in and help one group. Look, life happens, right? One kid transferred schools. One girl went on homebound. That left a group with only 2 people. You know, they were struggling. People didn't want to leave their groups. I try to jump in and help. So, you know, you just try to navigate those things, which I think are just, you know, more skills that the kids are going to take with them.
Yeah, I think so. And you really hit the nail on the head there, because that's one of the, like I said, I'm sure just like me, like all your kids aren't going to go out and go be investigators or sociologists or do any of this. You know, they're going to go do what they're going to do, but they're picking up those skills. 2 things I'm always telling my students in all my classes is I at one point I had it written on my whiteboard. It's, I don't know, you tell me. Because anytime a kid brings a problem to me, it's like, well, how do I do this? I don't know, you tell me. To, you know, force them to go like solve their own problems, find a solution. And then also all those kind of like social dynamics and working with groups. And that's, I found, and I've had students that have graduated come back and tell me that was one of the most useful things they learned from the class was how to work in a group. Because they'll come to me and they want to, these are 18-year-old, you know, young adults, and they're coming to me tattling. They're like, you know, so-and-so's really not doing anything. And they're being, and I always tell them like, listen, have you had a conversation with them? Have you, I'm happy to sit down and mediate with your group. But you guys need to talk. And now if you're trying to solve the problem and everybody's doing their best part to communicate and they're still causing trouble, then I'll step in. But you guys need to try to solve this on your own. At least in my class, I know, you know, when I first started doing that, it would like, they're just, hey, you know what, just never mind. I don't care. They just don't want to have that kind of, but you know, they've gotten used to it. And it's like watching little business meetings. You know, we'll pull aside to the library and say, okay, sit down. I'll sit here. Let's talk about what the issues are. And every single time they've always worked through it. And I think that skill is one of the most important things that they are going to have moving on to their adult life, is being able to communicate and work with other people and solve problems.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're exactly right. You know, to be honest, what allowed most of these killers to continue to kill was they were killing across jurisdictions, across state lines.
People couldn't get along.
And man, isn't that right? Like,
yeah,
you've probably seen so many cases where federal, state, local, multiple local, and they get involved and, you know, they all get into some type of match where they're trying to, you know, pull rank and, you know, do this, and people get upset and they don't want to work together. And I thought, wow, these kids are going to be one step ahead, right? They're going to know that even if it's difficult, even if there's issues or trouble, you can find a way to work together. So, they're doing great. And the best part is not when I give them the solution. I hate to do, I've done it. You know, you go to somebody and say, we're going to have to break this group up. You know, maybe we need to do something different. But I love it when I'm thinking about doing something like that and they come up to me first and say, you know, we were thinking about this and we're not doing a very good job. We need to do this, this, and this. Like, that's it, right? You want them to be able to look at what's going on with them, with their group, with people around them, and say, and this isn't good. How can we, you know, make this better? And somebody told me one time, it's kind of like in sports. The better that camaraderie is in the team, the better the product.
Yeah,
Right? So like if you can get a team working well together, their product is going to be better. So those are some of the things that when you do projects and you do group work, that's some of the stuff that you're working on, because the kids will do more of the work, get the product good. You really have to work on that part.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And that's why, you know, it's important to me to address this part of the conversation, because I see the same thing. My kids put out the Underestimated podcast, the first season. It went all the way up. I think it got up like number 6 in the iTunes charts. It was, you know, it was a huge success. And I think everyone then looks at it like, oh, well, how is they just have all these perfect kids that are just, and they're just all working together. It's like, no, that's not true. And I think it's important for people to realize what these kids are really learning, because it is a struggle. It's a struggle every day. And they're learning how to navigate. I don't know what to do next. I'm just bored. I'm having a bad day. My partner's not pulling their weight. And I don't like her attitude when she talks to me when we're doing this. You know, all these, like, that stuff happens every single day. And that's what, beyond solving a murder, making a podcast, writing a book, what the kids are learning is they're learning how to navigate that, which is I can't stress as much. And it's like, you agree, like that's one of the best skills they can learn.
Yeah. I mean, I have a huge passion for project-based learning. I just got back from a conference in Orlando sharing about how we can use true crime in projects. I mean, I just got to be honest, if you let me get on my soapbox for just a minute. This old idea that you can just hand kids a textbook and they can read and they can do a few bold words and answer the questions, and that's going to prepare them for the future. I don't know if that ever held a lot of water, but it definitely doesn't do it now. You think about AI. I mean, mm-hmm. It can know so much. Like, I don't know if memorizing stuff and answering, you know, basic questions is going to set kids up for a lifetime of success. We better be good at what the computers aren't very good at, which is being human.
Right.
Learning how to humanize people, learning how to work together with people, seeing the gaps and the problems, and how we can come up with new ideas to work with those. So, like, that's really what I enjoy about teaching. I don't stand up at front and lecture very much in that class. And in all my classes, I've done less and less over the years. I let the kids do more and more. I believe teaching is now, and probably will be in the future, more about creating a learning experience for the students and then setting them on this pathway and letting them do the work. And then we come in and find what they need and try to help get them those resources and those people, you know, be a guide for them. But it's really about creating a learning experience, if you ask me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I'm on the same soapbox, and I have that conversation at my school with my district, with my administrators. As a matter of fact, my principal had me head up an AI integration committee, because we're just trying to, not to say that we're just going to start using, but to basically to figure out how to navigate this. You know, it's easier for me. I'm a vocational teacher. You know, I'm already teaching, but I think of, like, you know, math teachers, or even like one of my good friends at school is a social studies teacher. And I just think, you know, when she's the way she's teaching, the way she was taught to teach, she's always taught in the way that was the necessary and only way to teach for so long, which is a lot of, you know, for like world history or U.S. history, whatever. Like, if you want to know who the order of the presidents, you have to just read, memorize, regurgitate, right? That's how we do it. And now we live in this world where anyone can say, you know, hey Siri, who was the 19th president of the United States? And it'll spit the answer out to them in 10 seconds. And then, and my biggest issue is student apathy. I always say, like, the hardest question, and that's what I pose to our committee that we're putting together, which is made up of teachers in all different departments, is when a kid asks you, why do I need to learn this? That was always a difficult question to answer, honestly. But it's so much more difficult now. And these kids aren't stupid. You know, it doesn't mean, oh, we don't need teachers. It's exactly what you're talking about, like finding a way to, you know, use to humanize the content you're creating and teach them to think in a way outside of what a computer can do. Because, you know, when somebody says, you know, why do I need to know the order of the presidents? What's the honest answer to that? You don't. You really don't anymore. And that's a hard, and I, and like, Yeah, I always, you know, tell like my coworkers, I'm like, I understand that's a tough pill to swallow. Like, that's your job. That's what you've been doing. That's what you were taught to do. And you went to college for, and you've been doing this for 20 years. And now you're being told the thing that you're teaching them to do, they don't need to know anymore. You can't honestly answer to them that you need to do it because what? Because you won't have a phone in your pocket. Like, I didn't even know that was sitting there. I was just talking to you and it answered me. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that's just me acknowledging I'm on the same soapbox you're on, that, yeah, we need to find new ways to reach these kids.
I tell people all the time, if AI can do your homework, maybe it should. Why are we having kids work on things that the answers are already out there, right? How about we find a way to use AI as a tool to solve some problems that haven't been solved yet? Now, here was the problem the students had. You can't go to ChatGPT and say, you know, who killed this person? If they don't know who killed them, it can't give you an answer.
Right.
So what you have to do is say, how can I use the tools I have to maybe figure out who is a suspect, who could be a suspect? How could we rule out some suspects? So I'm all for integrating AI. And hey, let's turn AI loose with this creativity and energy of young people. And let's see what kind of problems they can really solve, problems that need to be solved. So anyway, that's where I'm at. But anyway, it's a big soapbox. It's room for plenty of people.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's, you know, my thing, someone said it to me in a conference I was at. It was like, if you can use it to do menial repetitive tasks that don't require thinking, and if you can use technology to do that part for you, it's not that it's replacing. What it's done is it's opening up all this time to do something like, you know, write a book, solve a murder, you know, or whatever the thing is, because, you know, it's like, we don't need to waste time memorizing stuff. We'll let the technology do that. And let's use that information somewhere else. But anyway, I'll jump off the soapbox, as we can go on this for 3 hours and not even scratch the surface. But I do want to talk about, before I let you go, you guys wrote this book. Mm-hmm. You already had the iHeart podcast, Murder 101, about you guys. And then now I see it just in the, this is going to air on Sunday, the 12th. Shortly thereafter, this airs, there's a major like documentary coming out about the work you've done.
Yeah. So there's two big things. Let me share the book. First of all, one of the things that the students hoped would come from the book is that it would maybe lead to law enforcement or maybe even families. Anybody can get this book and see if this person might have had something to do with this crime. And so one of the things the students had to do is we gave this information to law enforcement. We're not trying to make money off law enforcement. I mean, if they can use this book, we gave them some the information, the electronic information, and the students had to share it out with every single jurisdiction that had a possible victim and this is hundreds of jurisdictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
You won't believe it. But before the book was even out, after we just reached out to law enforcement about a week before, chief of police in another state called me and said, hey, I just got this message, you know, from the front desk, like, what's up? And I told him, and he said, I've never heard of this. And I've been in this office for 40 years. He said, let me go look. That sounds very interesting. He has now reopened an investigation, and they feel very confident that he probably did kill someone in their community years before he was arrested for this other crime. So I know this book is a tool that law enforcement or others can use, and I'm really excited. Actually, that's the work we're going to be doing this coming year, is we're going to be working with this law enforcement agency to do the work to see if we can let people know what kind of true monster he really was. So that's been very rewarding, and I encourage all law enforcement, you know, to take kids seriously. You know, the work that your students do, like, I know they're kids, but they can do some great work, and they've got plenty of time on their hands. All the digging and stuff that cops just don't have the time to do. I mean, I've got 30 kids and we've got 50 minutes a day for 180 days. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work they can do. So that's what they did, right? The cops could do what they can do. The kids can do what they can do. So I hope people will look at it. But really what's happened in the last year has been amazing. After the Murder 101 podcast came out, actually 2 years, after the Murder 101 podcast came out, it was heard by a Hollywood couple. One did producing, directing, writing. And when they heard it, they just heard actually half of the first episode. And she looked at her husband and said, "This is our next project." And he said, "What's it about?" And she said, "I'm not really sure, but I love it." She said, "I'm only halfway through episode one." They listened to a couple episodes. They got a hold of KT Studios. And they said, this deserves a larger audience. And so they filmed for about a year inside the classroom and outside the classroom in Tennessee here with us. And then they've been, it's been in post-production for about a year. And so the world will finally get to see what actually goes on in the classroom and what the students do and how it impacts their lives. It comes out on July the 13th. That's next Monday, 1 week from today.
Yeah.
On Amazon.
When people hear that, that'll be tomorrow.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. So it's a three-part episodic documentary series. They're each about an hour apiece. And really, it will catch you up on some of the previous things, the Redhead Murders, the 1980s, the original class. And then it's going to let you go inside the class and see what we did last year. And mostly last year, we tried to help two families. And so the first half of the year, we're really working hard on Lori Pinnell, who was murdered and left just south of Memphis in Mississippi. She had just been identified a couple of months before the class started. And we actually got to work with her brother, who came all the way from California to be a part of the class. It was amazing. It was amazing. And then the second part of the year, we tried to help Tracy Walker's family. She was a 14-year-old girl who went missing from a mall in Indiana. She was found dead here in Tennessee years after she was murdered. And it's been 46 years, I believe, since they found her. And if she was so, the body was so degraded that as far as forensic evidence, there was basically none. You know, helping to try to get some attention on that case, to get some leads, so that maybe that case could be solved. Because that's the last chance there is on that case, is maybe some real human intelligence.
That's awesome. So what is the documentary called, or the docuseries called?
So it's called Murder 101 as well.
Okay.
And I really do. Of course, it was accepted into Sundance. Sundance only took two episodic documentaries to premiere there this year, and ours was one of them. Got to go out to Utah, and there was eight showings. We sold out every showing. There was four ovations in the first showing. People loved it. And I think that the reason people are interacting with it is because it's a new genre in true crime. So far, as far as I understand, there's only been three genres in true crime. Or three ways to look at it. Number one, you look at the victim. Number two, you look at it from the offender. Number three, sometimes you look at it from the police or the people who try to solve it. But this one, actually, you look at how it changes a young person into the person they're growing into by looking at these crimes. It's really a coming-of-age story. And how does learning about other people and their struggles and justice impact these young people as they're growing and begin to learn and develop these very things in their own minds? And it's very powerful, very powerful.
That's amazing. And that's going to be on Amazon Prime, right?
That's right.
So Murder 101 on Amazon Prime. Are they going to release all three episodes all tomorrow, all at the same time?
All three, binge worthy.
So
I'm going to be up
it.
At 6 a.m. over here on my side of the country, watching all three. There's actually a big premiere here in town at one of our historic theaters, which is going to be a lot of fun. Community is going to have a lot of ways to interact with it here where we are. But yeah, anybody can find all three episodes. They're supposed to upload them at 12 o'clock on the West Coast. So if you're on the East Coast, maybe about 3 a.m. And I told my family I'd let them sleep till 6, but I can't promise I won't be in there maybe watching it before they wake up.
Have you got to see the fine cut? Well, yeah, because you went to Sundance, right? So you've seen the final cut.
Sundance premiered the first episode.
Okay.
So I have only gotten to see the first episode. And I hated it because it ended on this amazing cliffhanger. And then I had to wait 6 months to see episode two and three. But episode one is so good. And really, you know, if you think about the way a story's told, episode one is really just some backstory and kind of introducing some characters.
Mm-hmm.
You're really going to get some powerful things in episode two and three, where you really get to learn more about the students, the families, the victims we're working with. And you actually see it begin to have a huge impact on the students. So I really can't wait to see how it turns out in episode two and three, but I think people are really going to love it. Very rarely do you watch a true crime documentary and feel good at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, somebody got victimized. Some family's crying. You know, it's sad. Some mm-hmm. offender who might have had their own terrible life. You know, they've been locked away forever. Like, you always just feel kind of bad at the end. And there are victims here, and there are, you know, unsolved crimes, and that's going to be there too. But there's also like this goodness that comes through where you see students learning to care about other people and try to help other people that have a problem that's not related to them at all. They're just helping them because it's the right thing to do. There's something really special when you see it, those eyes.
That's incredible. And Alex, you're doing amazing work, and I really value your kind of mentorship with my class, and I'm going to be picking your brain even more going forward because, you know, my class is still evolving to figure out the best way to do this. But everybody, so check out tomorrow on Amazon Prime, Murder 101, 3 episodes is going to come out. You can binge it all. There's the Murder 101 podcast that you can find in your podcast directory still. And I'm going to let you give the title of the book's too long. I'm going to mess it up. So tell them the title of the book again.
Yeah, it's Driven by Rage, Fueled by Diesel.
Driven by Rage, Fueled by Diesel. Check that out anywhere you get your books. And Alex, thanks so much. And man, congratulations on all your success. And I look forward to seeing up in another couple of years for the next crazy, amazing thing that you're doing.
Well, I appreciate it. But I always, every interview I do, I always want to say this. 8 years ago, my students said, if there's anything good going to come from this, if any family's going to get any closure, if any of those women are going to get their names back, it's because we're going to bring it back up and we're going to make people care about these women. So the fact that you wanted to hear this story and you're putting this out the way you can is actually a part of making those original students' dream come true. And the thing that I'm very excited about is that there will be more people hearing and learning about the women who were involved in the Redhead murders and possibly getting more tips so that we can get some of these cases solved and some closure for these families before it's too late. More than ever, more people are going to see this Amazon Prime special than any other thing that's ever had anything to do with the Redhead murders. And I can't wait to see. I look, nobody's told me anything, but I just feel, I'm a believer. I feel that in my heart, something good is going to come from this. One of these crimes is going to get solved. Some of these families are going to get some closure. And some of these evil people are going to be held accountable for what they did. So thank you for being part of the solution.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.